effects, really. The first thing that tends to happen on your machine is that the firmware gets loaded. That's the BIOS on a PC machine. Firmware can be big, it can be small, it varies. But the firmware passes control to the bootloader, which is usually loaded off disk, and the bootloader's job is to load the kernel.
This is Linux.
In our world, this is a kind of a large piece of software. It runs completely in sort of protected mode on the CPU, so you can kind of, it's big, you don't want to run things like a web server in your server, in your kernel, so you have a user space. The kernel has to start user space somehow, so it runs a program called init. Init is a process ID of one. It can never die. If init dies on your system, bad things tend to happen. The kernel actually will just oops and panic at that point and won't carry on. This is actually for various reasons. Because init is process one, it becomes the parent of any process that has its parent has died. So all the daemons on your system, init is actually the parent of those. So init has to be the process that reaps those children. It's quite important that init is actually running for this reason. And init has various special semantics as a result. So go on to a little history lesson of how we kind of boot a machine up with init. Init gets loaded, process ID 1. But init's job, therefore, is to start everything else, including like terminals to log in and all the daemons and services you actually want to be running. It does this, at least in the olden days, and by running a shell script called etcrc, etcrc, depending how you pronounce it, which is just very long, kind of complicated shell script that goes off and does everything, mounts the disks, starts the network cards, configures the interfaces, starts all the services that need to, daemons that need to be running. On things like OpenWRTs and embedded devices, that's actually still a very simple shell script, usually. And one of the things in it also has to do is run Getty or X or anything complicated. Sometimes that was in the RC script, sometimes it was in the init daemon itself. This problems with these, quite myriad. It's quite easy to write, but it's not very maintainable. It's very difficult, for example, to have a package like Apache be installed and actually go ahead and modify this single one big RC script to kind of make it so Apache gets started. So what came along there is things like BSD came along, and they generally the RC script did something like have a directory instead, so you have an RCD directory. And mostly this is the RC script iterates this directory, and it can run lots of individual scripts in this directory one at a time, waiting for each one to finish before running the next, which gives you multiple shell scripts and is much easier to maintain. Apache can install a script into that directory, and so on. System 5, slightly different. The System 5 gives you multiple profiles, or run levels as it calls them, where you can have five or six run levels. To support switching between these run levels, instead these directories gain start scripts and stop scripts, sort of beginning S and beginning K. They were generally the same shell script and received an argument to tell it whether the system was going up or down. This is kind of, this allows switching between the run levels, and it also allows kind of the system to be start up and shut down by switching run levels. But otherwise, it's basically the same system. So that, the only difference between that and that is that one has sort of start and stop at the previous front, one doesn't. And that's pretty much where we are today. I mean, this is grossly oversimplified, but it gives you a basic outline of what most Linux distributions are shipping. Start off in run level 2 or 3, you run each of the scripts in that directory in order, waiting for each one to complete before moving on to the next one. So you get pretty much a boot chart. Everyone probably has done anything with boot, is pretty familiar with one of these. And you get a boot chart which looks a bit like that. Init is the process that starts, it's running all the time. It starts individual scripts like RCS or RC2. Those iterate those directories running each thing in order. So in this case, we have UDEV, mount, and network being run under RCS. And then we switch into run level 2, and we run it through like dbus, hal, Apache, GDM. But you notice things like we're having to wait for Apache to finish starting before we can start GDM in this model, which is vaguely inefficient. It's worked for quite a long time, though, so it hadn't really needed changing. And again, this is sort of very, very oversimplified. If you actually look at the one, for example, on Ubuntu, there's probably about 80 to 120 different processes being started on boot, and many of them are long-lived. And I've kind of just omitted the detail to give you an idea of that one starts after the other and kind of goes on down, and that there's dependencies there we don't really want. So, booting isn't everything, though. We actually, in a modern system, have a bit more reactive, and you might have things like ACP scripts. So when ACP events like the battery going low or going on AC power happens, you want to run different scripts. You have things like the network card coming up and down, you want to run different scripts. And every application that does this at the moment implements its own script dispatcher. So you have etc/acp scripts, you have etc/apm event.d, you have etc/dbus event.d, you have a whole myriad, pardon me, you have a whole myriad of different directories with each one with different rules. So the things in etc/rcd, those, if they end in .sh, get run differently to not ending in .sh, but for things in etc/apm, they might have to run end in .sh and so on. There's all sorts of different rules and behaviors. So this was something we've been considering suboptimal for quite a long time now, and generally really kind of, it was one of those things that's been nagging to fix, but probably not high priority enough to just do it on its own. And then, you know, so sometimes you have things like, I mean, the one I can think of is the ALSA library, where we have to save and restore the mixer settings. So sometimes these, you know, in ACP scripts, we call the init script, telling it to start the service. Sometimes we say, tell it to stop the service. So, you know, it's sometimes these actual dispatcher scripts just call the init script. And there's kind of bad things happen. We had several problems where a sort of a script would be called with stop at the same time as it was being called for start for a completely different reason. So you try and restore and save the mixer settings at the one time, or you try and start and stop Apache at the same time, or any silly little things like that. So what happens if you do that? Bad things happen. It doesn't actually do that. We're not claiming responsibility for exploding Dells, but it kind of it tends to go wrong. You end up with a sound card that, for whatever reason, when you boot, is muted when it was completely fine when it shut down last time and the volume was set. You end up with just little annoying things. But the trouble with annoying things is one annoying thing is just annoying. 100 annoying things over a period of 2 weeks can actually leave you feeling with a bit of taste in your mouth. You don't want to use Linux. It's not as good as Windows. You know, we're trying to get users from all walks of life to kind of use it, and being sort of their laptop not quite functioning perfectly wasn't really useful. So this is kind of something we wanted to fix, but it was only kind of building up. We were actually looking at doing this just by kind of some better wrapper around init scripts and so on. It wasn't really sort of a big thing for us. However, there is another thing that was kind of a completely separate topic of conversation, a completely separate set of problems that we had to address. And these two combined a bit later. So, So we have this problem of tasks. Tasks are things like mounting a direct disk, things like saving a mixer state, and they can be started at any time, and they run until they stop, and they run because something happens to the system. And then we have services like Apache, which are respawned when they die if you want, and you know, running when the system's in a particular state. Just put those two sides in there just to define the terms. They caught me by surprise because I moved them this morning. Moving on. That's the computer kind of most Unix users were using 30 years ago.
There's a nice sigh of nostalgia from a couple of
people in the room. The lovely PDP-11. The interesting thing about the PDP-11 was they did actually have removable disk drives. You know, you could kind of take the disk out and plug it back in again later. Admittedly, they had to generally be at least powered off or detached first. So, you know, 30 years ago, we had big monolithic computers that didn't really change that much. 20 years ago, it was an Apple II or an IBM PS2. Again, they're not really computers that change that much. The PS2 is interesting simply because it had detachable keyboard and mice like on the bus, but especially the early PS2s, if you unplugged or unplugged the keyboard while it's running, it could actually fry the motherboard. So it wasn't something you'd actually consider hot plug, at least not for the normal definition of hot. And even if we look at 10 years ago, I'm not actually sure this one's 10 years old, but it was kind of Google Images thought it was. So this is, but you can see it's a pretty much a modern computer. It, you know, we've got sort of images sort of that we can start to see things we're used to seeing now, like there's a CD drive in there, there's a PCI cards. It's not actually hot swappable yet. It's not, you can't detach and unplug things. And we get to see our first laptops 10 years ago in common use. But again, these are quite bulky, quite single entities that kind of don't change that much. But today, this is actually my laptop, we have a little bit more of a difficulty dealing with hardware. For example, your keyboard and your mouse might be USB connected. They can be plugged in and unplugged at any time. You can have multiple keyboard, you can have multiple mice, and you can have little presenter gadgets that appear as a mouse for a while or a keyboard for a while, so you can wander around without touching your laptop or doing a talk. So, you know, those continuously appear, they disappear. You have removable storage, which is not necessarily a disk. These are things that, you know, we're so used to using. It's probably the one device that killed the floppy disk is the USB key, you know, which can be detached and plugged in and unplugged at any time. And some people actually try and have root file systems on these things, or at least slash home on these things. It's very common. You also have other forms of removable storage or removable media. So you have an iPod there, which is appears generally as a file system with some interesting semantics. But we also have removable sound cards. We have removable sort of, so removable sound card example is actually a headset because a USB headset appears to us as a sound card. We also have digital, you know, firewire devices like cameras. There's, you know, that's just on a typical laptop. This just was me going around the ports on my laptop there. There's also SD cards, and then there's PCMCIA PC cards, which can be detached and attached at any time. It's got a Wi-Fi kill switch, to actually, which actually detaches devices from the internal bus and reattaches them again. It's pretty hairy, and then just to make matters worse, there's an entire separate PCI bus you can plug the laptop into when you get home, which adds even more devices to it, like CD-ROMs and stuff, and actually literally is a PCI hot plug device, so we can literally removing hardware cards. So the modern machine is a little bit more complicated than ones we had sort of 30 years ago. So we kind of have this problem. The particular problems we were kind of facing was, as I said, home is on a USB key. This is actually quite common. A lot of people have like encrypted home on their USB keys now because they can plug it in into any of their three machines, four machines, wander it around. But of course, the problem with home being on a USB key is that, you know, the person boots the machine without forgets to plug it in. If the machine reaches the point where it tries to mount the file systems, it will just stop. It will probably crash. It will give a shell prompt or ask for the root password to go into maintenance mode. What it won't do is recover nicely if they found the USB key from down the back of the sofa and actually plug it into their computer. Yeah, there's another problem. User/user is on a network file system. It's quite common in sort of server environments. It's probably a little less common now than it used to be, but it's still common. But users on network file system, and the network card's removable. PCMCIA card, network card, user on a remote file system. You've got to bring it up in the right order. You've got to hope the PCMCIA card kind of comes up in time. You've got to hope it was plugged in. Otherwise, you're just going to fail to mount slash user. You're not going to carry on. SCSI RAID hardware nowadays takes a while to initialize. SANs take ages to initialize. You know, you start, as Matty Wilcox is going to be doing a talk a little later about why SCSI probes and stuff take so long and when they're asynchronous and stuff. So that will kind of fill you in some of the kind of crazy buses and stuff that are being dealt with now. And these things, you know, from a user space point of view, we load the SCSI module and kind of kick our heels around for up to 3 minutes waiting for some disks to appear. And, you know, that's a while loop with sleep statements in it because there's nothing else we can do. And, you know, Ubuntu Edgy does have this while loop in its init ramifest. So we have kind of these problems. I mean, here's a really, really nasty one. Network card, PCMCIA network card needs firmware to be uploaded, or, you know, the IPW in my laptop or your laptops, the Atheros, anything like that, they need firmware to be uploaded. And to get on the network, it needs to negotiate WPA because it's a secured wireless network. DHCP actually takes a little while after that. The server's under heavy load. And all of these things need to come together for a single server. You might be running a squid proxy on your laptop to bind to that network interface. If all of these things haven't happened during the boot sequence by the time you try and start that server, it will just fail to start. And it won't be restarted if these things happen. You know, if the DHCP comes up when you're logging into GNOME on your laptop, that doesn't mean Squid will then get started. It actually means Squid has failed to start. You've got to go investigate why, and so on. These are kind of suboptimal things. So we had these kind of two conversations going on in parallel. We had this whole, we don't really like the fact we're dealing with these shell scripts that start services, stop services, do all the hard work themselves, and we're running them from about 18 different locations, sometimes with no locking to prevent us running the same ones at the same time. They're difficult to configure. And the second set of problems, which is the fact that when we boot a machine, it's very hard for us to boot a machine at the moment and get it up perfectly without any race conditions, without anything clashing, without anything sort of sticking over each other, basically. So two problems, and you know, we're having to deal with. So we looked at some of the new init daemons to replace this. So hands up if anyone here has heard of initng, which is a dependency-based init daemon. So a few of you. And hands up, anyone's heard of Solaris's SMF, the Service Management Framework, which is another dependency-based init daemon. So I'm using initng there, just picking on it, because I found its logo, which is actually a really great logo. I really do like that logo. it's just kind of So how do these things work? Well, dependency-based init daemons, the way they work is a bit like package managers, really. You have to have a list of goals of what you want to be started on your system for it to know what it needs to start. So in the case of initng, these basically, the run levels are the list of packages, jobs that you want to be started as part of that run level. In Sun SMF, it actually, the goal is anything your services configuration which isn't manually disabled. So first of all, you get this list of goals. Goals have dependencies. So you know, Apache needs the network, GDM needs to mount the disks because you need slash user and stuff like that. And you know, those dependencies can also have dependencies. In this case, in a Linux system, both the dependencies there would be UDEV because we need something to get the devices off the kernel. So then what happens, it calculates these dependency trees, which gives it an order it can start services. So it can start UDEV, it can start network and mount GDM in parallel, fortunately, so it's, we've reduced the boot time a little bit, and we can now start Apache and GDM. So that's how a dependency-based init daemon works. The problem with that is that doesn't actually solve any of the problems we're trying to solve. They've set out to try and solve the problems of easier administration, so you can just drop your service in and list the services it depends on, and it works out what order to start things, and the problem of boot speed, because it automatically orders it in the most efficient manner, in theory, to actually boot it fastly. We didn't really care about that. We care for a little bit about that, but we've been tackling boot speed by a completely different method. So, you know, by actually looking at what we're doing in the boot sequence and trying to make sure we're not trying to do too much or too little, or do all stuff in the wrong place. So it kind of didn't really fit in what we want to do. And here's why. We don't want to depend on UDEV. We want to depend on ETH1. We want to depend on SDA1. We want to depend on things that were not definable as dependency jobs in a dependency-based init system, i.e. initng or SMF. We want to depend on something that is fundamentally a hardware device. And hardware is not something that's ready on demand. You can't depend on ETH1. You can kind of do it. You can write a job that sits there in a while loop until it shows up and kind of releases when it's ready and so on. But it's not really an efficient way of doing this. You can kind of mash it together, but not really. Now, the interesting thing is, this seems already solved. Anyone who saw David Zeuthen's talk earlier will have a much better picture of how this works. But this is a very simplistic overview of the kind of the Project Utopia stack that we've been using in Linux for a while now. The kernel can send events to UDEV. We call UEvents these days, which replaced the SBIN hot plug wrapper. UDEV can do things like call modprobe to load kernel modules. It can also inform HAL of these kind of events. So HAL gets on a socket the event from the kernel and tells it what to do. It can send the message over dbus, so the sys puts it onto the system bus. That message can go to the session bus and so on. So from the system bus and session bus, various policy managers, policy agents, and hardware managers can actually respond to these dbus messages. And also, these kind of processes can also directly talk to the kernel with methods, things like inotify, K events, if you've sort of been following future kernel patches and so on. So we actually have a lot of rich events now about what kind of things are happening on the system. So, you know, let's take you through a typical example of a series of these events we get. That's just simplified, just to give you the idea of the paths. We get a message from the kernel telling us a PCI device has been added. UDEV calls modprobe. That loads a driver. That driver fires off a series of more events because now we have an actual network interface that ETH0 has been added. UDEV can tell HAL that ETH0 has been added, gives it the event. HAL puts a dbus message out saying there's a new network interface. Network manager receives that dbus message. It can call something like DH client. It can bring up the IP address and so on. It can configure WPA and everything on that interface. It then informs over dbus again a message saying that ETH0 is now up. So we have an event-based mechanism ready in place to do a lot of the difficult stuff about hardware. We don't need to sit in while loops. We can just literally select until we get a dbus message. We can select until we get a message from UDEV or from the kernel. And there we go, that's the thing again. In fact, there's actually several places we might want to conceivably start and stop services or run tasks on the system, which has been traditionally the kind of the preview of the init daemon. UDEV, there's actually a good compelling reason to run devices from UDEV, which we're getting to run sort of tasks and services from UDEV. HAL, absolutely, definitely from HAL. Policy kits kind of can decide whether it's, I think, I'm not quite sure what that is, I just
sure today, but
things like whether it's a kind of camera or things like that, and sort of with HAL. And we get messages via Dbus from HAL. Network Manager gives us messages on over Dbus saying things like the network's up. There's a very rich source of these kind of events which would be useful to start, stop services on the system
and run
different tasks. In fact, we can kind of isolate a whole bunch of them. UDEV, there's hardware, we get events, hardware is added or removed to the system. Also when kind of kernel objects like device mapping devices and stuff. So we can get very raw events telling us a PCI device has been added, a block device has been added, a hardware, sort of anything hardware to a network interface. And we can run really low-level things like HD PAN, LC utils, set the hardware clock and stuff from those kind of events. And these are things at the moment we try and do in the boot sequence by guessing how far into the boot sequence that's likely to happen, which is not very reliable. If we did it as a direct result of the UDEV event, you would have completely bulletproof mixer settings being saved and restored. You have bulletproof hard disk DMA getting enabled, and so the hardware clock would not kind of wander between UTC and not, depending whether you were using DHCP or not. From HAL, we can have hardware events with policy added to them. So telling us things like whether it's the default sound card, whether it's a digital camera, whether it's a device and it's the console user getting added. So at that point, we can run things like management daemons or printer daemons or so on. We can start and stop things because there's actual physical hardware there to, you know, because the service requires that hardware. Network manager. Go and power manager, go and volume manager, all of these things create a very rich source of events. Network manager, we can use the same events as other things like a legacy if up down on a Debian server. We can, you know, make those issue the same events to upstart in this case. And we can run things like syncing the network clock, mounting NFS file systems, running network daemons that actually require to bind to a network port, you know, require to bind to an IP address that only exists once it comes up. We can stop them again when we pull the network card down. And you know, in Power Manager is a little typical example there that you can stop Beagle when you're on battery power just by changing a config option if you have one central service manager. So this is where we came up with this idea of an event-based init daemon. And these kind of combined all of these problems we've kind of been talking about and all of the kind of knowledge of what we're doing with UDEV and HAL and stuff these days. So the event-based init daemon. It originally got called Wendy, but that was a really bad pun, so it got called Upstart in the end, which is probably worse, but seems to actually fit it quite well. So we can use the same example as I used for initng, but show you how Upstart reacts to this. The first thing is it sends out a single event. It's an event-based system. It's got a message kind of passing system in it. It sends out a single event. It's actually just called Startup. It's not very original. And as a byproduct of that event, or directly from that event, you might start UDEV, which is a service that gets started, it runs, and it's UDEV then starts receiving its kernel events, it starts kind of dispatching them. And from UDEV, depending on the event, you may have filters in place and UDEV rules, you may then transmit additional events into Upstart. One of the really basic goals we came up with was that Upstart would just have no knowledge of these events. It would be just literally define the format of them, which is just basically a string name, some arguments, and environment variables that go along with it. So they look a little bit like UDEV events or HAL events. And that's it. It would then dispatch them and start and stop services or run tasks as a result. So UDEV can just sit there. It can select. It can receive events from the kernel. And depending on those events it received, it can issue events saying things like a block device has been added and a network card has been added. Upstart in this meanwhile is just waiting for events from UDEV. UDEV can pass these events to Upstart and say, this has happened. And then as a result of that, we can then mount the network, mount the disk, and start and then bring up the network card. So we now have a very event-based mechanism for bringing up mounting disks and network cards. This would be, for example, disks that are mentioned in SCFS tab, network cards mentioned on Debian Etsy network interfaces. When you're in a desktop situation, sometimes these things, especially removable disks and pluggable network cards are better left to session policy daemons, but they're good examples for the problem. And as a result of these kind of things, we can do Apache and GDM. Should be probably noted as well, the network there would actually have it, so the network events there could come from network manager, the mount events there could come from GNOME volume manager. We'd use the same set of events for this. So you start Apache, you start GDM. One of the obvious advantages of this, if you didn't plug in SDA1, it doesn't matter, because all you have to do is go find it, plug it in, and it will just resume. It will carry on down that right-hand branch, and then GDM will get started. If you don't have your network card plugged in, it doesn't matter. The minute you plug it in, it will get processed, it will get added to the system. You get an event saying the network card's been added, Apache will be started. And as soon as you pull it out, Apache will be stopped. This is assuming Apache listens on that bind port, for example. So we have this kind of very rich series of events, and we kind of came up with this init daemon based on this. There's kind of a whole thing going on for a little while once we announced it about dependency-based init daemons versus event-based init daemon.
The obvious pro
is an event-based init daemon is very reactive. You can kind of, it reacts completely to your system. It brings up whatever your system is able to bring up. You can have jobs sitting there and services sitting there that don't come up simply because they're not needed for this computer. And it's very flexible. We can ship a default configuration that will work for everybody. Whereas in a dependency-based system, you kind of have to tweak it a bit. But there's a lot of cons in mind, there's cons with it. And especially the big one is that an event-based system has no goal in mind. Whereas in G, you have a big long list of services that you must start, and you can create a flexible error message that tells you why it's failed. In Upstart, it actually doesn't, because it kind of doesn't never stops booting. It just assumes that the system is still booting and is taking a while. But that's actually not a bad thing, because it actually turns out displaying an error message on the console, given the brute shell, isn't necessarily the most useful thing you can be doing at that point. And in a typical sort of distribution environment, we'd ship a lot of things that made sure that, you know, if after a certain period you don't have a root file system, we can bring up useful messages telling people we haven't had a root file system. We can respond to failed events and tell them why it's not coming up. We can offer them root shells. And actually, by, you know, not having in our mind this idea of booting the system, by eliminating that entirely, by just saying that the system is booted when the kernel passes control to user space and everything else that happens just happens, we don't have this problem of, well, the system stopped booting, so now your USB disk won't get mounted until you logged in. And, your system has finished booting, so now even if you plug in your network interface, you're not going to get all those services that network interface was actually using. So there was that con there, but we think that con is completely sort of subsumed by reacting properly to these events. So that gives a kind of idea of what event-based init system is. So in an event-based init system, or in any init system, we'd define what we'd run. I mean, this is going to be an example of a service here. So we'd say we'd run the dbus daemon with a system bus, and we want it respawned because we want it to die. Going back to the original first few slides, after that, we already knew that we didn't want shell scripts starting, and we didn't want shell scripts stopping things because most of that code is copy and paste, so you may as well put that logic into the init daemon itself. And this is most of them, like init and GSMF and launchd in the Apple case, behave like this. So it seemed logical, and actually we've carved up much testing, it's exactly the right thing to do. A mistake some of them make is assuming that's all you need to do to run dbus. In fact, actually, you need to run code to do things like make directories for it, set the permissions, remove, clean up things afterwards. So as well as actually giving a daemon or a binary we need to exec and monitor, we also have scripts around that. So you can even write that whole thing as a single shell script yourself, where that shell script shouldn't terminate until the daemon terminates. So we left the flexibility in there. The only thing you don't do, you don't write a script to start it, which terminates with it started, and a script to stop it, which terminates when it's stopped. You now write a script to get it ready to be started, get a script to clean it up after it's been stopped, and then kind of in the middle of it just say what you actually want Upstart to run directly itself for you. And
Upstart in the middle of it doesn't necessarily come out so well,
but it's a state machine. The great advantage of having a state machine at the central of your init daemon is that even if you're halfway in the middle of this state machine, when you decide you want to start the ALSA mixer service, if you decide you want to stop it, we have a flexible method of getting back to stopped. It looks really insanely complicated, but it's actually mostly kind of, there's four states in the boxes. You're starting a service, you're stopping it, you started it, you stopped it. And the same is true for tasks. The only main difference is the tasks stop themselves. And for any given point on there, we can either leave it by a green arrow because we want it to be running, we can leave it by a red arrow because we now want it to be stopped. And
somewhere in there, can't really see it, it's on the top left, top one, in the middle.
The running diamond. You notice we can leave that via green and red arrows in two different directions because sometimes we want it respawned because it died and we didn't expect it. And sometimes we want to kill it and restart it. That's all that means.
So that's
just the state machine in the heart of Upstart, which is all it really is. It's a state machine which deals with processes and an event passing, so message passing daemon. So within that state machine, we've defined a job, we've said what it's run, how it gets started, how it gets stopped. So we'd have to tell it what events we want to run it on. So we can give, very simply, the event name is just a string, FHS file system mount in this case, to mean user, var, etc., all up, and stop on it when they all get unmounted again. These kind of all together. So this isn't necessarily flexible. It's actually far better to define a state in which this is running. So we actually give it as a period between two events in this case. The advantage here is we can actually now say, so FHS file system mounted to FHS file system unmounted here. This event, by the way, is just generated by our default mount script. So it can be anything you like. But I think some policy and standards would be useful for sort of an LSB or kind of similar level. So we can define that to say you can run the system. This will be traditional to multi-user mode. Or you can define network up and network down. The advantage of defining a state is you can combine the two. You can say this is running in the state, so you know, a typical daemon like DBoss is running in the state when FHS file system mounted to FHS file system unmounted. But something like Apache or Squid, you might say from FHS file system mounted until FHS file system unmounted and network up until network down. So you union the two periods between the events and you can sort of intersect them as well. So you might, another just little going quickly over a couple of its other features. When things like HAL, you can actually, Upstart supports the notion of locking on events. So if, you know, when you start and stop DBoss, it generates events, which HAL can then use. But with the special start stopping event, HAL can actually be stopped fully before DBoss is allowed to continue stopping. So HAL can actually be ensured that it is completely stopped and shut down before DBoss is sent the term signal. The advantage of this simply is that you don't get a log error log in the HAL error log because DBoss went away under it. And likewise, we have an equivalent starting event as well as to actually ensure that something is started before HAL is allowed to start in this example. So you can, and there's also obviously the started and stopped events which tell you that service is gone or has arrived. So that's basically kind of how you define it. You define a job, something that progresses through the state machine, and you define which events cause it to go which directions through the state machine. And just because we can define arbitrarily complicated periods in which a job can be run. So this, for example, defines that a event of a user logging in during daylight hours while there's an active network interface and the FHS file system is mounted. And that is just in one job. If you want that job also to be run hourly, you just add the word "and hourly" on the end of that. So there's one place you can configure when a service is run. You would never really use these, but it's an interesting stress test of the mechanism to invent things like this. So yeah, that's our boot chart we've got at the moment. It's a staggered one thing running at a time. And the obvious advantage to having an event-based mechanism when things happen is you can actually eliminate all the white space. You can run things in parallel. When UDIF starts, you can mount the network interface, mount the network drive, mount the network interface in parallel. You can start DBoss and you can start HAL, DDM, you can start those in parallel with Apache. It reduces the time. In practice, this is a little bit of a lie, because if you're doing multiple things at once, they actually get a bit longer because you're time sharing at that point. But in general, this is the advantage of any init daemon is that the modern init daemon is you get this reduction in boot time. And the principal advantage now for us is not this reduction in boot time, it's the massive increase in reliability. We know now that if your network interface comes up, we can start, we can stop things. So just give you a quick 5-minute overview at most about the development progress, actually probably 1-minute overview. Upstart 0.2. If anyone here is running Ubuntu Edgy, you are running Upstart today. We shipped it in Edgy. We made a little bit of fanfare about it. What we actually did there was we shipped it, but still running the existing RC scripts and still running the Gettys. So we literally just replaced the init daemon. The reason we did this was it's a great way to test something while being able to roll it, rip it back out again if it goes horribly wrong. And it was basically to prove the concept that an event-based init daemon can be flexible enough that it can emulate the existing one, as well as doing all the new things while we test it. So it kind of had very simple things. If you use Edgy today, you can do init control list, start service, starts TTY1, stop TTY1, and so on. And it will still do a shakedown. 0.3 or 0.5, whatever it's going to get called, will be shipped in Feisty. Events are now more complicated. They have arguments and environment. We can define the foo until bar. We can join things, foo and bar. And our plan for Feisty is to have a native boot sequence using Upstart. So the RC scripts will only now be used for packages which haven't yet been converted to Upstart and third-party things which we're not, you know, they won't convert just yet or probably in a million years. We retain that sys5 init emulation forever. But we intend to have this native boot sequence that's just purely event-driven for Feisty, which releases in April.
Future plans?
Upstart 1.0. Timed events, kind of place, we call it cron anachron support, but in reality, that makes a lot of sense, as well as being able to define calendar events to be able to define periods, 8 a.m. to 4 a.m. every day, 50 minutes after network up, every 15 minutes while network up. You know, it makes sense to be able to find these things, and it's very low cost. Upstart already has to do timers to do send signals and stuff, so it's actually very cheap to add this. Things like INetD support, our general thought there is that it would be a separate process because it's so cheap to send events to Upstart. Would have the separate process like INetD listening, and it would just send messages to Upstart if it needs to start and stop services. But I don't think that's going to be probable for Upstart ever.
Upstart one.
I'm not entirely sure we'll ever really want that because it's kind of specialized. INet
and process communication.
Right now we have an IPC mechanism. It allows you to start, stop, create the status of services. We're thinking of adding things like keep alive and pings to that so you can actually talk to the service and get startup notification.
That's
something Nokia want for the
NEMA
kind of environment. And then obviously things like a geographical server manager UI to extend the existing kind of command line utilities. So they're kind of where we're going. I mean, that will be, Upstart 1.0 will be probably by the end of this year,
we hope.
So there we go. That was the end of the kind of the introduction and stuff. There's a website with more information on all the original documents we wrote, a mailing list. Upstart on Freenode is where we hang out to do development stuff. And there's a URL with the specifications and stuff we're targeting for the 0.3 release for
Feisty. And the open
office crashed 3 times while I was doing this, so that's my Trish Linton. So yeah, thanks very much, and I'll take some questions, I think.
Sorry. If you want to start up here.
If you come down to the microphone, I should say, actually, if you want to do questions, because it saves this person running around all the time. Yep.
Yeah, what communication have you had with other distros? I mean, I don't use many other distros unless I have to, but what other distros have you talked to about getting them to use Upstart as well?
So yeah, what communication with other distros we had? Upstart is one of my projects. Although I work as Ubuntu as a development manager there now, it was always one of my projects. I actually emailed the original documents over to Red Hat, to Fedora, it was sort of the same thing, to Gentoo and to Debian and so on. So I have that, they're all fully communicated. I've been sort of trying to talk to the distros and stuff. My sort of basic hunch is that they're waiting to see how well it works or how badly it breaks. I have appointment to talk with David from Red Hat Fedora later today, hopefully, about stuff and the overlap with some of the work he's been doing. So, but there has been communication there. There still is communication there. Gentoo seems to be quite happy playing with it at the moment. So, yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
What are you looking to probably do with things like the etc.init.d scripts that do reloads and restarts and things like that?
So, restarts generally, restart tends to be start stop, but where it's not, the general plan is to add like the notion of actions. So as well as telling a script to start or stop, you can add an action there, which does something custom. To be honest, that's not highly specified yet. The
mailing list and
the Launchpad spec tracker is a great the wiki on the website. Join in the development. So this is still 0.2, 0.3, so we're still developing it. And any ideas that anybody has on those kind of things that are missing, please come in and specify it. The other distributions should join in as well, and we can work out the best way of doing this.
So I'm using Upstart, and
yep.
I'm in a marginal Wi-Fi area, and I've got a lot of essentially route flapping. What kind of dampening do you put in for that? Because a lot of network daemons flapping up and down.
Yeah, in that situation, if it was going up and down a lot, you'd get the rate limiting code you'd hit that stops it respawning services too fast. Just basically like in.
Is there any chance of having start and stops happening at the same time in
yeah.
that situation? So, I mean, you it's...
So no, because
so the network interfaces come up, the starts are all running. There's lots and lots of daemons still starting, but the Wi-Fi goes away, and then all the stops start to happen at the same time.
So no, one of the kind of the original kind of plans was to make sure that you couldn't end up in that situation where you had multiple things. So a job can only be one place in a state machine at one time. So if it's running
and it gets started,
and a message comes in to get stopping, all that means is it follows the state machine in a different direction. So the daemon would probably get pre-started and stopped. Again, so you would kind of get some churn, and then obviously you'd have dampening code or rate limiting code to stop it being run.
There is some rate limiting code.
There is some primitive rate limiting code in there at the moment. We'll add more as and when we find we need it. Really, it's a small amount of code, so it's quite easy to extend at this point.
Make this the last question, thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I just had one as a user, as a laptop user, and one as an admin. For an admin, How would I have a service set up, like to start on a particular event? Like you said, they were just strings, but is there like a definitive list of what services define what strings? So I know like where what action should kick off my, say, server that I've written?
Yep, there's a mechanism for services to find which events they emit. We're probably going to recommend people write man pages for them as well. And there'll be kind of, when we add things like the UI and stuff, then we'll put kind of that kind of thing in there. Yep, that's okay. Definitely planned.
And can you also have it so that it's more, your example was that like you have something come up because Ethernet one's up. Can you have something just says network available? Is it like a more generic term?
Yeah, network up. It's one we're using at the moment.
Okay. Cool, thanks.
Right, thanks. Well, anyone else has any questions or wants to grab me? I'm here all week. I said, can you kind of come up to the front and talk to me or kind of grab me just kind of when I'm wandering around between places, and we'll be completely happy to answer anything that you want to know and give you any demos and stuff. So thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Scott. I just have a small gift for you for speaking today. A small gift for you.